is Armstrong versus Clarkson College. Mr. Welch, good morning to you.
May it please the court, I'm Brian Welch here on behalf of the appellant, Clarkson College. You are never closer to death than when you're under general anesthesia. Clarkson College takes the education of a student as a CRNA very seriously. The verdict, I believe, of the district in the district court and the denial by the district court of the motion for direct verdict and for JNOV shocked the conscience of this court. This case involves a graduate student who makes some very bad choices at a critical time, admits that what she did was unprofessional, and admitted that she needed to be on probation. When the consequences of that probation ultimately result in her academic dismissal from the program because she could not progress, rather than follow the grievance procedure, which was in the policies under which she was charged, acknowledges in her own blog, which is Exhibit 131, and the court hasn't read it, but I ask you to please do so, acknowledges that she has that procedure available. Rather than use that procedure, she immediately jumps to the district court and files for a temporary restraining order. If that is the status of the law, you are going to become a lot busier. Counsel for the plaintiff will stand up here, I'm sure there's an easel here, and he's going to put up a code of conduct. I want to talk about that right out of the gate. That code of conduct does not apply in this case. This student was never charged under the code of conduct. If you look at the 13 or so things enumerated there, she didn't violate any of them. She was never charged.
Why was she put on probation?
She was put on probation because the policies and procedures under which she was charged is the nurse anesthesia program policies and procedures. There's two of them. There's a handbook for anesthesia students, and there's the NAP, nurse anesthesia policies and procedures. It is that policies and procedures under which she was charged. And those policies and procedures, it specifically states in the front of the document, these take precedence over any other procedures of the college. These apply to her specific program.
What were the specific charges that Clarkson claimed applied under the Code of Ethics?
Yes, that she had violated the AANA Code of Ethics, which the policies provide. And there's actually an ethics class that this student attended, taught by Mary Overston, where it is gone over in detail.
What does the Code of Ethics do with off-campus social events?
It specifically addresses that if you're in an off-campus environment, you're still subject to those rules. This was a professional conference of nurse anesthesia from all over the country. So this is a professional conference. This isn't on a private vacation down to Disney World. This is a professional conference.
So charging someone with violation of the Code of Ethics generally then is going to result in their termination of the program, isn't it?
It can.
Well, what other relief do they have if they're charged and put on probation? She can't go to one clinical area because she's on probation. How does she stay in school?
Well, she can't progress. Now, in this case, she was placed on her probation and her primary clinic site was UNMC.
Right.
So at the time she's placed on that probation, UNMC has not made a determination as to whether they're going to allow her back. When UNMC decided unanimously that she created a patient safety risk and no longer allowed her back in the program, There were only four other clinical sites.
Doesn't Clarkson deny that she was a patient safety risk?
Yes. We did not know at that time that that was the basis for their vote.
Okay.
We didn't know that at the time. So the program director, we only had four other clinical sites. And these are not something you just snap your fingers at. They take over a year to establish, and the Council on Accreditation requires that that be set up. They all said no, she could not progress in the program. And it's specifically in the policy, Your Honor, and I would cite it to you. It's in Exhibit 129. It's page 7. And it says, the program expects students to adopt and observe the AANA Code of Ethics. Violations of this ethical code of standard will be regarded as professional and academic misconduct and failure to meet clinical performance objectives and be subject to review as such. This was an academic decision. And under the law in this state, as well as every other jurisdiction that we've been able to find, that is required to great deference by the court. This case never should have gone to this jury. And we cite
I may be mistaken, but I think your opposing counsel argued in his brief that you never really made that argument down below.
We did. Made it in our motion for a directed verdict. I specifically cited to the court the case that I'm going to mention right now, the Al Daba versus Case Western Reserve case, Sixth Circuit, 2015 case. And that I cited that to the court because it is directly, I think, on point to the case that we have here. We have a medical school student who is very good academically. But it was professionalism. That is the reason why the Case Western Reserve Medical School did not want to give him a degree. And the Sixth Circuit goes through all the cases because of that lack of professionalism.
What was the lack of professionalism in that case?
In that case, basically he was a jerk. He would not show up. He was rude to patients. He would not do the work that he was supposed to do. So,
well, you wouldn't say that that's analogous to the case in front of us.
It's analogous, Your Honor, because the decision was academic. It's not discipline. Professionalism, all the cases, as well as Doe 2, which Judge, you have written, Miller-Learman, specifically says if it's academic, it is entitled to that deference, and it's an arbitrary and capricious standard. And I see that I'm up on my rebuttal, so I'll let counsel.
You may. If you can set that up in a way that you don't block opposing counsel's view.
Your Honor, if I could move to
you may.
That may be helpful.
You may.
Thank you. May it please the court.
Good morning to you, Mr. Bruno.
Good morning. My name is Jason Bruno. I'm here on behalf of appellee Kelly Armstrong, who is here in the courtroom with her husband and her mother today. Mr. Wells told a story that is not borne out by the facts or Clarkson's own policies and procedures. Let me start with the document behind me, which is taken from Clarkson's Nurse Anesthesia Handbook. It's Exhibit 101, page 92. And as it shows, it sets out the procedures and circumstances for when a student like Kelly Armstrong could be placed on clinical probation and have her clinical privileges removed.
Is there a significance in that you're claiming that this was under the code of conduct and opposing counsel claims this is under the code of ethics?
Not necessarily. I'm claiming it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Basically, the jury could have chosen which policies and procedures Clarkson didn't follow, because they didn't follow any. But if you look at this one, it specifically states, a student may be removed from the clinical practicum and placed on clinical probation, exactly what happened to Kelly Armstrong, for the following reasons: compromising patient safety, never happened, undisputed. Poor judgment or application of the accepted standards of anesthesia care, never happened, undisputed. Failure to demonstrate satisfactory clinical progress, never happened, undisputed. Failure in the clinical course, never happened, undisputed.
Can you go back to Justice Wright's question, if you recall, that he posed to opposing counsel that is this the case that once the student is on probation, expulsion will naturally follow because arguably you can't do clinical things and now you're not performing academically?
Absolutely not. Number one, they couldn't have placed her on clinical probation. They didn't have the justification.
No, I'm not talking about the reason for probation. I'm just saying once a student is on probation, sure, can they perform clinical tasks and make and recover their status?
Absolutely, because if you look at Clarkson's other policies and procedures, it says once a student is placed on clinical probation, they shall be given an opportunity to improve their behavior. That's two Clarkson policies, admitted at trial that they had the responsibility to do that, admitted that they never gave her any opportunity to improve her behavior.
Are they required to give her an opportunity to improve behavior before she's placed on probation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then secondly,
where do you get that?
From there's a separate board actually that I have on my other board. It's right here. This is another one of their nurse anesthesia policies and procedures. We'll be given the opportunity to demonstrate improvement. And then if you look forward, probationary status will be reviewed after 4 weeks. Kelly Armstrong didn't get 4 weeks. She was removed about 15 days after they placed her on probation. Now, I'm going to go separately to Mr. Welch's argument that the code of conduct does not apply in this case. Well, the jury heard evidence that it did. And the reason is because after this incident occurred, Kelly was hailed into the disciplinarian of the school. Never met him before. He's the guy who told the jury, I have nothing to do with academics. My job is to enforce and interpret the code of conduct. He told Kelly two times, and it's also in the records from that meeting, what you did in Washington, D.C. violated the student code of conduct. Minutes later or hours later, she was placed on probation. So if you look at the code of conduct that Mr. Welch is scared of, and he should be, it has basically full due process. You get a hearing, you get witnesses, you get to call a lawyer, you get a full record of the proceedings, you get two appeals. She got nothing.
Under the code of conduct, do you actually get a chance to improve your behavior before you are placed on probation?
Under the code of conduct, no, but they cannot place you under probation under the code of conduct without a hearing, without a judicial, without a determination by the judicial council, which was never conducted, never held, never met. So, I mean, you could pick and choose which policy of Clarkson's that they didn't follow, because they didn't follow any. And in fact, they kicked her out of the program under an administrative withdrawal. And you can look at their five handbooks of policies and procedures. You won't find it in there because it doesn't exist. They made up the policies and procedures to kick Kelly Armstrong out of this program. Mr. Welch also indicates that this was an academic decision. Well, that's the first time we've heard that argument, because Clarkson knows it is not true. Kelly Armstrong had a 3.84 GPA. She was academically in good standing. Clarkson told the jury that she was a bright, talented, and valuable member of the Clarkson class.
Mr. Welch likens this to student in Doe 2. Are you familiar with that?
I am, and it's
okay,
nothing.
How would you compare the supposed failings of that student with your student?
They're not even close. Kelly Armstrong had absolutely no problems whatsoever in her class, in her studies, with the patient, with patient safety. On a bus coming back from a costume-themed party cruise on the Potomac River, wasn't near a patient.
Okay, so the elephant in the room is, okay, is there carrying on in D.C.? Is that an academic event?
No, and let me give you the best reasons. If you look at the letters that Ms. Hoberston, the director of the program, sent out, beginning at Exhibit 121, she sent out five to all the clinical sites. And what did she say? Ellie's problem is behavioral, not academic. That is a position that they created on this appeal to because they know that there is plenty of evidence to support the jury's verdict below. And if you go a little further, we know that this wasn't an academic decision. You know why? Because they called in Tony Damewood, who's the disciplinarian, who admitted that he has absolutely nothing to do with the academics of the school. He is the disciplinarian. That is a position that's disingenuous and that's taken now. In addition, the Clarkson's main argument on appeal isn't that there wasn't sufficient evidence for the jury to find that it did, but they believe they're entitled to some heightened standard. Well, that was never pled or raised. If you look at the amended answer Clarkson filed during trial of this case, there's not a word in there about academic deference, heightened standard, or that they're entitled to an arbitrary or capricious standard. They raised that issue. They never raised that issue or gave us notice of it before trial. And it's something that should not be considered by this court on appeal.
You summarize this. Your argument is that this is a simple breach of contract case.
Correct, absolutely.
What are the elements of the contract and what was the specific breach?
The specific breach, well, there are threefold. One,
what's the element of the contract? What contract did they have?
That Kelly Armstrong would pay them money and they would provide her everything that she needed to do in order to earn her degree and become a nurse anesthetist. In exchange, she would do what she was supposed to do. And the terms of that contract, as admitted by Clarkson's representatives, are set forth in the policies, handbooks, and procedures. And Clarkson admitted that they have to abide by those policies and procedures, especially before they could have imposed discipline on Ms. Armstrong. We believe there was plenty of evidence of
a breach. So how would the contract have been upheld, assuming that your client did some inappropriate things in Washington? What does the contract then require Clarkson to do?
Three things. One, we didn't think they could do anything for what she did in D.C. If you look at the policies and procedures cited in my brief, it prohibits them from considering behavior outside the classroom or a professional setting. That's number one. Number two, if they wanted to impose any discipline on her, they have to follow their own policies and procedures in order to do so. You could start, number one, with following this one to have the criteria to remove her clinical privileges. Undisputed, they didn't have that. Number two, we think they had to follow all of the provisions in the student code of conduct, which is bring a formal complaint against her, tell her who the witnesses and evidence against her are, let her hold a hearing, let her hire a lawyer, let her defend herself, let her be found guilty, let her hold appeals. And if you go beyond that, they also had to do all the other things, even if they imposed discipline on her, which is give her a chance to demonstrate improvement, which they admittedly never did. And they had to allow her the opportunity to extend the program. That's in two of their policies and procedures. They literally, I'm not exaggerating when I said they literally didn't follow a single one of their policies and procedures.
Well, what about their argument that she didn't meet the condition precedent to bring an action for breach of contract by not filing a grievance?
Well, the grievance procedure on its face says it doesn't apply in the instances of a student code of conduct. There was evidence presented to the jury. Mr. Welch is making the same argument now that she shouldn't win because of that. They rejected that argument because it's not credible. Tony Damewood came in and told her, hey, you're in trouble for what you did in Washington, D.C. You violated the student code of conduct. Well, the grievance procedure doesn't apply. And if you go further, how could she? By the time she found out they kicked her out of the school, they never told her. She was calling Mary Hoverston to find out what's going on. Mary Hoverston didn't call her back, so she calls up the registrar a week or 10 days later, and they say, well, you're not a student anymore. We're not going to give you your final financial aid. Who's she going to submit a grievance procedure to? As soon as she found out, she went into the judge and said, hey, judge, let me back in this program. They had no right to kick me out. We've been fighting ever since, and the jury did the right thing in this case. There are no more questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, 2 minutes.
2 minutes and 27 seconds. Mr. Welch.
Time to talk fast. So, I just heard counsel say, yes, we charge her under the student code of conduct. We never did. You know, it's akin to a criminal case. You don't get charged. You can't come in and say, oh, well, I was charged, should have been charged for first degree murder. We never charged her. Those whole policies never kicked in. The policy
why
procedure.
Why was she put on probation?
She was put in on probation under the Nurse Anesthesia Program Handbook that specifically says students have to comply with the Code of Ethics. She violated 3.4 of the Code of Ethics. She was placed on probation for that reason. The policy that you just put up for clinical privileges that are suspended, she was never placed. We never suspended her clinical privileges. What happened was is the program, she did this in front of the worst person she could ever do this in front of, the chief CRNA at UNMC at her clinical program.
Counsel, yes. Counsel, the ethics issue, the argument you're making here today, did you present this evidence to the jury?
Absolutely.
Okay. And then the jury weighed your position on the ethics versus their position on the code of conduct. Isn't that a factual issue that the jury made?
No.
Why not?
I believe under the case law, not only by this court and by other courts, when you have an academic decision, and that's what this was, you can call it anything you want. We've got the Horowitz case. They determined that was academic, and it's because the guy smelled bad. We got the Aldava case, that the guy lacked professionalism. Those are academic decisions. That is entitled to great deference, and it has to be, by this court. It never should have gone to the jury. That directed verdict should have been sustained. The JNOV should have been sustained. It never should have gone to the jury. And with the 30 seconds I've got left, I didn't talk about the fact, their argument is that deference is an affirmative defense. It is not. It is plaintiff's burden of proof. It is a prima facie element that the plaintiff has to overcome. There isn't one case that we are ever able to find when you talk about deference where it is an affirmative defense. Look at the Doe cases. They were all on summary judgment as a matter of law. Okay, it went to the jury on a breach of contract. I got none of my affirmative defenses. I got no instructions on my affirmative defenses, and there was ample evidence. Judge Wright, the grievance procedure, the impossibility of performance, I got none of them. Mitigation, none of them. Thank you.
Thank you very much.